mortgage bond is at the end, is in front. So rent is precedence to mortgage bonds. How can that be? Three quick questions. The one is regarding the repo rate, which has just been increased. What do you imagine the impact will be on credit in the country now? The second point is on the dark clearing. The banks and the financial institutions are saying that can impede their ability to lend because they don't know how to assess their clients. What is your view on that? And lastly, I haven't seen the full submission, whether there's a clause draft with proposed amendments. That would be very helpful. Thank you very much.
Macintosh?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I must say you're a very tough customer coming back after a catastrophic of becoming chair, because it's obviously a compliment to the Reserve Bank, I think. Well done, Madam Chair. Mr. Kanyaho, it's good to hear your voice. We see you a lot and hear your name a lot, and thank you for that. And indeed, the Reserve Bank, if one wants to think of it in financial terms, is just not the cool or grandfather of all our financial institutions, but he also is head of family and has serious responsibilities for our financial health. I have one question. In a sense, if you use Reserve Bank terminology page 8, in regard to the matter of amendment of 70.4, on page 8 you say, it is submitted that contractual arrangements require consensus between regulations. And if one has Reserve Bank speak, that means we have to have these contractual arrangements. And I know that you're too polite and sensitive to be prescriptive. But it seems to me that it's important that we as a committee should apply our minds and the DTI to this very polite comment by the Deputy Governor Kanyaho. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable McIntosh. Honourable Waili.
Thanks very much, Commander Chairperson. I think I want to move from the basis of what has been presented. First and foremost, let's upload the presentation. And I think one of the emphasis from the Reserve Bank is an issue of financial stability. But it's always important that even if you've got a financial stability, but if there's no political stability, how do you strike that particular balance? Because currently you find that there are a number of strikes that are taking place, which is within the constitutional framework. But also, if you look at some of those particular strike actions, the service delivery protests, those impact terms in terms of the view of the investors, especially the foreign direct investment. But how do we strike that particular balance, the political and financial stability? To me, that's part one of the most important aspects. But also, how do we deal as a country with an aspect where it is perceived that number of workers find themselves in the debt trap because of that we're not providing as a state in terms of the adequate social wage. You find that workers opt to go for private schools, whilst we've got public schools. They opt to go for private hospitals, whilst we've got public hospitals. The issues of transport system. Well, the situation which leaves workers with no disposable income, the rest of the society. You would also find the domestic workers sending their kids in the private school. But how do we strike that particular balance? It may not be the issue of Reserve Bank alone. But I think I've got a keen interest in terms of the response on that question. The second question relates to the high level of indebtedness in the country. What are the impacts, negative impacts on the production? Because a worker was indebted, it affects the morale, it affects the morale not only the workplace, in the society at large. What is the impact on the production and the economy of the country? And have you also taken study in terms of number of workers who are retrenching, who are not being retrenched, but workers who are opting for provident funds and they reside voluntarily, and that impacts in terms of creating increasing the unemployment rate, because with the hope of accessing that money and being able to settle their debt, do we have a database in terms of understanding the magnitude of that particular crisis? I think the last one is the issue of what you have raised in terms of the abuse or the gaps in terms of the multiplicity of the regulators. That the funds credit the providers abuse some of the loopholes. Are there no warning signs or what are the remedial actions that are in place in terms of dealing with some of those potential abuses? Thanks very much.
Yes, I can see Reserve Bank has proposed a number of issues. Honourable Salah.
We must thank the Deputy Governor for an enlightening presentation given. And I would love if you go into a long preamble in that regard. Clearly, Chairperson, it is coming clear that the National Credit Act, the Amendment Bill, and the National Financial Sector Regulation Bill have got a lot in common. But and the role of South African Reserve Bank and the role of the National Credit Regulator have got a lot in common. As on the one hand, the South African Reserve Bank has got a mandate to protect the value of the currency in the interest of a balanced and sustainable growth. That is very important. And to oversee and maintain financial stability. When you look at what do those mean in practice, they mean also that actually, it goes better here to say, credit provision and regulation is an important factor in which that objective, meaning the objective of sustainable growth and balance the sustainable growth and the protection of the value of the currency. Now, what we need to do is to go into specifics to say which areas are conflicting. Particularly as we move forward. And we would appreciate that not necessarily in this meeting, but that the South African Reserve Bank could be able to look into the two and say, in this area there is a conflict, this is our suggestion. In this area there is a conflict and this is our suggestion. On the issue relating to, I know that one area of conflict has been raised, and that is the area relating to the registrar. On page 7 of the presentation, because it specifies that certain things in the NCA require a certain particular relationship between the regulator and the register, and in terms of the twin peak, the register is facing out. Comrade Khadev asked, what is going to come in the place of the registrar? And I align myself with that question as well.
Thank you very much. Also expressing my words of appreciation, the input that we have received. My question or my comment is that with regard to almost one of the last points made on insurances, I also would appreciate that insurances are more regulated because they tend to move as lone wolves, and I don't think the wolves, you know, that are aligned to counteract insurances are equipped enough, or they are doing enough in that regard. And then when it comes to micro lenders, the way they are all over the country, it looks like every day gives birth to micro lenders. And the advert, they advertise in various ways. And because people are desperate, poverty surrounding so many people, what protection or what regulation can come up to prevent micro lenders from abusing this financial space? And my last one is the point that was made by our comrade, that many people have lost houses simply because they were lured into getting into loans to secure their homes. I'm talking in the township scenario. What say that can be done to prevent that? Because it is still ongoing, where a bank could simply give a loan to a young person who is not even the owner of the house. And when that young person fails to pay, they then want to through their lawyers, to take the house from the elderly people. And there's the biggest loss goes to the elderly people, not even the young men that secured the loans. Thanks, Comrade Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mabasa. Yes, Deputy Governor, there's just one or two comments and questions, if you like. The repo rate has already been referred to. It would be instructive for us to learn what kind of time lag are we looking at before we can feel the effects, the positive effects of this one. Obviously, decisions are being made about the MPC, but I'm wondering if half of 0.5, you know, is going to be a sufficient way to address this, the actual degree of that. I think it's in the right direction, but we may need to look at that. And the second thing one would like to get a response from you on is, a lot is made of this phrase, the price of risk. The banks will fall, the banks will fall. You start taking that away, you cannot ignore that. Well, I'm also saying we cannot ignore the impact this is having on the poor. We're creating an exclusive economy here. Where is this balance? And it would be helpful to understand what the Reserve Bank's position is on this balance. But that doesn't mean think we must just look at the price of risk you have. Now, the third point on this would be, you mentioned the insurance institutions and the like, but it seems that just about anyone can set up a financial institution. We heard of furniture companies, all kinds of companies, funeral companies, you name it. I mean, I could set up one myself, it seems, from my backyard, quite legitimately. I mean, is this what we're encouraging? Is this a replacement for Mashonisiwa? Is it? I don't know. Can we hear that from yourself, Deputy Governor?
Thank you very much, I used to think I had run away from the Finance Committee. They have an appetite for a lot of questions, and when I checked here now, it looks like I have 55 questions. So, yeah. Let me see how I deal with them. The questions raised by the Honourable Khadebe, which has to do with affordability, which links up to the question of Honourable Balag on loans to young people who can't afford them, and they end up taking away the granny houses. And I will deal with that and deal with that with that together. One of the things the Honorable Hadjari about the cell phone being priority, it's a very clever case, that one. You see, what you get is that you get an SMS that says, you are pre-approved for a loan up to 200,000. Monthly repayment will be 500 rand, and it doesn't say what interest rate you are going to pay, and it says just reply with the word debt. Correctly, the LPR has classified that as aggressive marketing of credit. We must be careful, because you are shoving credit down the throat of people who are not out looking for credit. That's because now you are offering it. People now are tempted to take it. Now, when they say you are pre-approved, the question comes. There are the issue of the affordability test that the NPR has set. If this provider has not spoken to you, how did they arrive at the conclusion that you qualify, you are pre-approved for a loan of 200,000? It got clear wrong. And such kinds of behavior have got to be curtailed. So, the test has to be done, and I think that it is very, very important that that responsibility is also placed on the institution, including the people who are running the institution, you said the CEO. It's important it gets dealt with, because the NCA that also provides that there shouldn't be reckless lending. And they are clearly spelled out what constitutes reckless lending. And the question is, when you have sent that SMS as a credit provider, and you do not know what I have in other hands, how did you arrive at a conclusion that is, I qualify for 200,000 and this is what? And when we talk about the issues of market conduct, disclosure is very key, because the most important thing in credit is the price of credit itself. That's what that SMS says. He says, this is the amount you are entitled to, this is how much you are going to pay per month, and doesn't tell you what interest rate you are going to pay. Those kinds of practices are the kind of practices that a market conduct regulator has got to be stepping in and saying, this is not appropriate market conduct. And that's why we are moving to this thing. We've got to create a market conduct. There was then the issue that you raised about the house and the house being taken. I still do not know why the granny is at 60,000 rand for an operation. An operation does not cost that amount of money in a public hospital. I will leave you, since you apply this trade college politics, I will leave you to deal with that. But me, I am a central banker. Let me say that the two stories of Honorable Khadija that you say and one by Honorable Balaza are different, because in your case, Mabasa, the Honorable Mabasa had said, is that in the case of this one that you said, the house was pushed as a mortgage. But in that case, the house was not even pushed as a mortgage, but was taken. That is illegal. Because they could only take an asset that had been pledged as security, or alternatively, if you are foreclosed as a customer, they will then say, what are assets you own? That young person does not own the house. That house is registered in the name of another person, and it cannot be taken. It's got to be wrong in law. The question was raised about what the alternative to the registrar of when we are creating the prudential authority. And what I talked about alignment is that then we are going to have to say what has replaced the registrar of banks in my worry is that if we have just left it in the legislation, this amendment as registrar of banks, and the registrar of banks disappears, then what is the counterpart? That kind of alignment of terminology that I was talking about. Now the issue of the payment system, which is the issue of what comes through, and one of the things that we have been debating is, friends will love you, because they have insisted that the mortgage must be the first one that goes through. And in a way, they might be right. Actually, I think they are right. Because you ask what a prudent person would have done. The prudent person would have said, roof over my head first, if you cut my cell phone, I will go and shoot a pay phone, or I might shoot a pay as you go. What would a prudent person have done? In our quest, sometimes when we make policy things, in our quest to promote small, medium-sized enterprises and allow small businesses and so forth, one of the proposals that came was that prioritize the small deductions because they will come from small providers and so on. And it sounds like very good in design. Except that I said to you how creative the financial providers are. That loan that we offered of 200,000, you are not going to get a loan of 200,000. You are probably going to get 10 loans of 20,000 rand each. Why? Because what they want is that the every deduction will be small, and that deduction will go out before the big deduction goes through. It's the gaming that actually takes place. There are reforms in that respect to try and change the rules. And what the bond is almost a system that randomizes the payments instead of saying we are prioritizing the small payments. But the issue of saying what would the prudent person have done? And there's the same payment that it must be prioritized like the payment for the house. It's an absolutely valid point. It's an absolutely valid point. And of course there's been the issue of rent taking precedence over mortgage. If I have to put financial stability here, I will say to you, of course you have got to prioritize mortgage over rent, except that there will also be a question. Why would somebody be having a mortgage and also be renting property at the same time? So in the design of the system, the assumption was that you are either renting or you are owning. You can't be renting and owning at the same time, unless you are a member of parliament and you have got a house in Polokwane and you are renting a house in Cape Town, you might be caught in that kind of thing. There was the issue of information sharing, which I must be very careful how I deal with. It's because when you lend money, you ask yourself, what risk am I exposed to? And the most important thing that we used to worry about is, when you first apply for credit, and they say, give us credit references, what other accounts did you have before? I have never had an account before. You are almost deemed not credit worthy. In my mind, you should be very, very ready because it looks like you didn't like that. Right? But they will ask those kind of things. The question is always going to be, who is the first person to go? So the history of the borrower is very important. You're going to have to balance these things. Do you want to say you are expanding that information, or do you want to say, if you have paid, it shouldn't preclude you from borrowing in the future? Think of this. The first time borrower ends up having to pay more because it does not have a credit history. When that information disappears, we might all be first time borrowers, in which case we would be priced that way. It's a noble. I have a suspicion. If I owed money and paid too slowly and I ended up being listed at a credit bureau and I eventually repay all the money, why did I continue to be punished? And I have not been able to pay because in that 6 months I was out of a job and now I have a job. You also have to consider all of this. What I'm saying is that in arriving at that, be careful to make sure that there are checks and balances and that there is a test that can be applied. Failure of that, the conservative lender, which goes to the point of, well, this one is clean, are qualified, and there is nothing on your record that shows you have ever done anything, it must be that that information was a fund. I'm not touching you, or I'm going to leave you pay more. That could happen. So it's important that a test is put in place to make sure that we deal with the unintended consequences. I'll give you examples of noble things we wanted to do with the payment system that ended up with consequences that we didn't think of. So again, I'm leaving that with you. There was the issue of the high indebtedness of consumers. One of the things that we do not have a database. But one of the things that we are picking up is that we are seeing high wage demands that do not seem to be commensurate with the change in the cost of living. That when you look at the cost of living, the demand can't justify that. And then you try to understand what it is. And here, instead of relying on anecdotes, I will wear my previous hat when I was the DG of the Treasury, that we found that in a public servant strike late 90s, early 2000s, some public servants fled a slip that says, look, I am only taking home 500 rand a month. When we analyzed the payslip, we found that there was a reduction to that micro lender, to that insurer, to that and so forth, and they are looking at that. The response of government was to shut down the deductions from the system. Say that we are not your payment collector, get out of the system. It is a very, very important point to raise. Because what we are seeing is that in some of the sectors, at the very least with the platinum sector we have seen, that we have found that people are taking home less, not because they are paying less, but because people have borrowed more than what they were supposed to borrow. And that is being deducted against their salary. Which then very big committee got to talk to the other committee. Because what was established was that garnishing orders were being granted too easily. These orders were meant to deal with matrimonial emoluments rather than all of the other things on credit. There is a particular behavior there that seems to be going beyond the limit of the committee, which you have got to talk to the other committee about. So the high indebtedness that leads to the consequence that people are demanding salary increases that are not necessarily commensurate with the change in the cost of living, but are driven by the fact that people were highly indebted. Which brings me to the issue of the provident fund of people resigning. It's not just in the private sector, we have seen it in the public sector, where people resign so that they can access their pension fund. And once they have accessed the pension fund, they come back looking for a job again, or they ask to be on contract and so forth. The Treasury with the Financial Services Board proposed in the pension reform mandatory preservation. Which means that you can't take all your pension even if you have resigned. That pension must be preserved, you should only be able to access it at the time when you retire. Noble intention. The problem is that sometimes somebody is retrenched and you say, mandatory preservation. And when the person is retrenched, they might want to repay their debt so that they have somewhere in between is a solution that would say something like you should preserve up to this amount of money. Or alternatively something that says that if you were retrenched rather than resigned, If you had 9, you can't be doing. If you are a strength, maybe you must. There are all sorts of combinations in between. But solution lies in mandatory reservation of some magistrates. After mandatory reservation, you will have people resigning so that they can access their provident funds and stamps. What do they do once they have done that? They do not have, they have not provided for their retirement. And when they reach retirement age, what do they do? They are putting a burden on the social security fund of the state, because now they go for the state old age grant, whereas it should have been somebody who had provided for themselves in the state. Multiplicity of registers was the legal step. It's a fairly straightforward. The creation of the treaty was meant to also rationalize the regulators. The biggest failure in the U.S. was that when Lehman Brothers went, or when AIG went, it was not clear which regulator should be taking responsibility. In regulation, fewer and better. It's not like the more the merrier. The more the choice, and the more you create an opportunity for arbitrage. So consolidation of tradition is actually very important, and particularly when it comes to the financial sector, it's important that consolidation takes place. The issue of the areas of complicating or conflicting objectives. I don't see a conflict of objectives. And the Red Book, which was titled A Safer Financial System That the South Africa Has, puts 4 objectives of financial regulation and does not conquer them. Let me put it this way. It is no point having a well-regulated financial sector that is the Rolls Royce of the financial system that excludes the majority of people from the financial system. It's also of no point to have a financial system where you say that the more the merrier, let me have a lot of people included in this financial system, and the financial system is not prudent, it goes under, and it takes with it the savings of the poor. It's of no point having a financial system that meets those 2 criteria, but lacks integrity, and is the subject of abuse by money launderers, and it possesses proceeds of crime. We set out those objectives and says all of these objectives are important. Yes, there will be a point where they are trade-offs, but we are not elevating one objective above the other. Because once you do that, the financial system will not be able to serve our economy in the manner that we would like it to serve our economy. Honorable Mabasa, you raised the issue of ombuds, and that they are not, do not seem to be equipped to deal with this thing. And that thing is not hard to fight. There are just too many ombuds. There's too many ombuds. There's an ombuds for insurance, there's an ombuds for... There are just too many of them. What we need is a single ombuds system for the financial sector. Because how do you deal with a conglomerate financial company that provides insurance, that provides banking, that provides unit trust, that provides credit, that provides all of these things? And I have an issue with that same conglomerate. But then I must go to the ombuds for insurance, and then the ombuds for bank, and the ombuds for this, and the ombuds for that. Think of somebody who is having a modest deposit and a small mortgage and maybe a retirement annuity. Why do I have the resources to go to all of the ombuds when I could be having one ombud that I could be dealing with? So they are not a piece, but they are also fragmented, and there are too many. There are too many of them. There was a question I have dealt with. There was the issue of the payment distribution elements and switching and so forth. the national payment system will, and the players in the national payment system will also be subjected to the prescriptions of the market conduct regulator, including how they conduct themselves in all of this respect. It's an important issue. The national payment system provides a very efficient mechanism to do payment. We do protect it. It's a very important market infrastructure that we have to ensure that it is always there, otherwise things will really fall apart. So it will be covered by these things, and this will have to be dealt with in that context. And the one thing that comes through, which we would have to deal with, is if you are a credit provider, because one of the things that comes, if you are reckless, there are all the tensions that are there. There is one important tension that we didn't think about, which we would have to deal with. I know that my colleagues, former colleagues in the Treasury have raised this, that if you have been found guilty of reckless lending, we should deny you access to the payment system. Okay? That would entail that there might be changes to the National Payment System Act. So we have to deal with it in this reform process in the Twin Peaks legislation. As a particular aspect of market conduct, whether we do not deny you access to market system. That deals with all your questions except for the one you are all waiting to hear about. But before I deal with it, let me deal with the issue of financial stability and political stability. I move from the premise that South Africa is a politically stable country. If we were not politically stable, I can tell you now, our job as regulators will be a nightmare. So, to the extent that there are spikes, there are spikes. One of the things then that we look at from the area of financial stability is that if there is a strike in a particular sector, we then check and ask ourselves the question, to what extent is the financial sector exposed to that particular subsector, and whether there are any steps that must be taken to make sure that the instability in that sector does not spill over into the financial sector. We watch that all the time, whether we look at housing sector, or we look at mining, or we look at retail, and so forth. We watch those, constantly. What we do. I got an annual analyst in the bank. They track this thing, and they would tell you what is there. And the last question, which is the most important one. There is the issue of setting up of financial institutions. Madam Chair, one of the things that I find that we have to deal with is to try and deal with illegal deposits taking things. They are popping up everywhere. And it is the same individual. You shut them this side, they go and open this side. Very simple premise. If it sounds too good to be true, it most probably too good to be true. When you hear somebody, when interest rates are at 5% or 5.5%, tell you that they can offer you a return of 30-50% per month, run away. Report it to the authorities, because that is most likely an illegal deposit taking. We are able to shut down so many of these things. Unfortunately, as I said, our job is to protect depositors. So if we protect depositors, we also protect the space within which people who are licensed to take deposits operate. So if you invade that space by taking deposits illegally, we will find you and we will shut you down. But we are also appealing to the public to report those things to us so that we can actually shut them down. What we do not have control of are people who are illegally lending money. And I can tell you that those ones who are illegally lending money, they are currently seem to be having a very good collection record, because they are the kind of people who do the things that do to take you down at that area and break your kneecap if you don't pay. How we deal with those people is another question. Because we do not quite regulate provision of the people who are taking deposits. And that is unfortunately where poor people play. That's unfortunately where poor people play. And those kinds of things are illegal. And they would require not just the national service regulation, not just, but they are going to require all law enforcement authorities to be on board with respect to this. Lastly is the issue of the time left, the repo on credit. One thing strikes me about us South Africans, as we have said, these interest rates have been going down for a good 6 years. My advice has always been a very simple one. The definition, classic definition of a banker is the one who wants to lend you money when you don't need it. And when interest rates are this low, they have not got to be low, they are still very low. When interest rates are so low, you should be repaying your debt. Not taking more debt. Because the monetary stimulus when we reduce interest rates was to cushion the economy against the very risk of the global turmoil. Household indebtedness had barely come down over this period. It came down from like 78% of disposable income. We are now at 75.5. It was supposed to have come down rapidly because people could afford now to pay and they needed to repay. And this gets felt, Madam Chair, you are asking how quick it gets felt. Well, if you are a borrower, you probably felt it yesterday because your bank is very quick. It probably would have sent you a letter and said that with effect from this day, your interest rates have now changed. You feel it immediately. The lag that it has on the flow of credit, that is a 12 to 18 month lag because the credit that is out there will continue to be there. It's when people feel down the line that this is now too much in terms of the cost of credit that they slow down. And in a way, when one asks why was credit that high, one would just say, yes, money was too cheap. Well, money is still very cheap. And I urge you, use this space to repay your debt.
Yes, indeed. We should use it, but you yourself, Deputy Governor, did refer to what I would call reckless lenders. Reckless. And they're very legitimate lenders as well, your big boys. I would like to, just as we close on this, to raise one issue. One of the first things that does become affected when we have this change, though, is that people are at risk of losing their houses. Now, notwithstanding what you said, we should all be responsible borrowers. Notwithstanding that, we accept that. Nevertheless, although this may not be, you may not be the person to which we should address this question, nevertheless, you may throw some light on it. Doesn't seem impossible to achieve a change in structure of mortgages and the repayments thereof. It would appear as if when credit card payments are involved, and loans, whatever extensions of credit, and motor cars, notwithstanding the difference in price, a principle is adopted that you pay simultaneously interest and credit, even though one may be less than the other, but immediately. When it comes to a house, first is interest, first. Now, I'm not sure if that's related to the price of risk and banks so on to throw into kickoff. At least if you get our money back, part of it in interest. So that if you get a defaulter after 2 or 3 years, it's almost impossible then to enter into an arrangement that you can effectively repay if you've been retrenched. So we're not saying that we should not have responsible borrowers. That's not what we are. But we are asking the Reserve Bank whether or not they themselves have not looked at this issue on housing. Many countries, as you know, have adopted a different approach to housing than South Africa, without collapsing. So I don't know if it's because of our particular environment that we're unable to review the structure of a mortgage. Thank you.
Mortgage and any credit, or even any investment, moves from one basic premise in finance. Money today is worth more than money tomorrow. So, the faster you invest today, the greater will be your future return. Let's invest that. You are a borrower. You have borrowed money over 5, 10, or 20 years. The faster you repay today, the less you are going to pay in the future, because you will bring down your credit faster. Why is it so? It's because the other guy sitting on the other side who lends you the money sees you as the investment, and they want as much of their money to be coming through today than tomorrow, which is why you end up with what you have had. Structure of the mortgage is South Africa, there are benefits. There are basically two types of mortgages. The U.S., which seems to be the still only country now, that offers fixed-rate mortgages for 20 years. Can you have a fixed-rate mortgage for 20 years? In South Africa, you can't get a fixed-rate mortgage for 20 years. You get a floating-rate mortgage for 20 years. Let's think of it this way. Where was the repo rate in 1998? 25%? That was the repo was slightly less than that. If you took a 20-year fixed mortgage in 1998, today you will be paying interest at 25% instead of 9%, which is where prime is. It's an important policy trade-off to make. We can also do it this way. That you might be borrowing money today, prime is at 9, and we have another 1998, and suddenly you are paying at 25%. You could get that. And what you then must be saying is, from a public policy perspective, should we be saying that you design a product that cushions people for a house up to a certain amount of money? Or should there be a provision? And the market does provide for that. You can get a fixed mortgage for a period. I think the longer I've been in South Africa is 2 years. Except that at the moment there aren't many fixed mortgages to come around because of where the interest rates are. So this is an important trade off. An important trade off here is that when you have a floating exchange rate and you floating interest rate and you want to provide relief. From the time the Reserve Bank started cutting interest rates in the early part of 2009, you have actually put money back in the pockets of South Africans during that period. If the mortgages were fixed, they wouldn't be facing with that. So it's those trade-offs that you are going to be faced with.
I'd like to thank you, Mr. Kaniago, and highlighting those areas of difference that we would consider in our deliberations. Thank you very much. really appreciate it. As requested, we take account of your other commitments, and thank you for coming here this morning. Thank you very much. Thank you. Members, we have now, I know we're running a bit late, but to echo the whip's words, is not only the second time we've had the Reserve Bank here on this particular issue. We're now going to move to Judge Fleming. Am I right? Judge Fleming. Where's Judge Fleming? Judge Fleming, I've heard the first name being judge. I've also heard of that being a title. Someone is a judge, in fact. Now, to me, it was not clear if, in fact, you are, in fact, a judge, or whether that is your first name. You are, yes, a retired judge. So, thank you very much, then, Judge Fleming. Please go ahead.
Man. So please put your hands up if I'm not doing my part. I thank you for the opportunity to share my concerns for the computer, for the consumer. What I have in mind is to submit to you that with the National Credit Act as we had it, and as the Bono affects it, it gives protection for some people, limited people. It gives protection on some contracts. And the protection which it gives is little and going down. The NCA, in fact, removed the most important problem of the ordinary man, the consumer, and that is what affects his pocket. The construction of the NCA is to a large extent, the first 80 sections, the last 20 is no problem. The problem
Excuse me, Chairperson. I've got one page here with the Dutch
Fleming. This one page.
It's the last page.
From the main. You were given a huge package, and in that huge package, you have the full, with the exception of this page, the notes that had been overlooked.
Can you just let me know where package Judge Fleming's 8 pages are?
It's submission number 3.
Number 3, thank you.
Can I proceed?
Judge Fleming? Please proceed.
The much of the sections are not contentious. When it comes to the question of the consumer and debt and interest, it becomes a world which is unsatisfactory. It is not of much use to the consumer. It has advantages. But I'm here not to compliment Caesar. I'm here to raise the problems which I have for you to decide or not. I think a good starting point is to say this: if a man is overdebted, but not with interest-bearing debt, in other words, it's not a credit agreement, can he go to a counselor and say, please rearrange my debt? He cannot, because the debts which he has arise from things which are not covered by the debt. This act only, I'm talking broad terms, covers something if there's interest payable and charges. But if you have a clean contract, I sell you my car, you pay me in a month's time, there's no interest revision, this act does not apply. Now, that I think links up with The problem which the Reserve Bank has mentioned, the suggestion is that this Act should provide for, shall I say, the court to give good view of the market. It won't, because under this Act, it refers only to certain types of debts. Now, just coming back to the persons who are protected. My first book I wrote was about the High Purchase Act. That went along through other legislation. Then suddenly, under the NCA, that disappears. You won't see adverts for it, you won't see contracts for it. The reason is that the trader says, look, you are not worth this debt, it's irresponsible credit. I can't sell you this car. You can't afford it. But, says the dealer, if it's a lease, we can contract. And what does the dealer do? He takes the price of the car, 100,000 rands. He adds an amount for interest for the period it's going to take. And the man, the consumer, in fact, economically pays interest. Now, I see this new bill says the definition of a lease is withdrawn. I don't know whether the idea is that the lease is no longer whatsoever under the Act, or whether there is some other meaning. On my interpretation, this Act does not free a lease or a movable as such. It doesn't in words say it won't apply. But it cannot apply, because in your lease, there is no provision for paying interest. In the lease, you pay the interest economically, but you don't know it. And the regulator won't know it, and the Reserve Bank won't know it. Now, the Income Tax Act, look through this, it says, look, well, that's in a different context. This is the Muslim complex. They also do not pay interest, it's against the religion. But they've got other schemes to get down this, which economically is interest. So for the society, for the community, for the economy, it is interest. For the protection of that man so that he can bank statements or whatever, it is interest. So the Income Tax has looked through this and it said, look, what you pay more than the price will be regarded as within certain limits as interest and taxable on it if you receive it. On the NCA approach, there is no interest payable. You just sell your car at a very nice price, an inflated price, and it goes. This Act is limited in its application for solving debt problems. As I understand it, we have debt problems. Over indebtedness problems is one part of it, but the debt control, debt within limits. Judge Masipa in Johannesburg, Matilda Masipa, at an early stage in, after the legislation, said this Act, forget that it is for the protection of the consumer, but it is there to protect the consumer and the seller against their own greed. And if you look at the purpose of the Act as it's spelled out, it's not only protection of the consumer, it's for a fair, good, sound credit system, but a fair system. So, you must look overall at its qualities and be fair in the process. Now, the Act has also, but it becomes a little technical, ways in which you can avoid the contracts. Not only by making a release, but I don't want to give ideas to other people. The question of which contracts are governed is again relative. Now, in my reasoning, and I believe other people think the same, if a contract is not fair, not under the Consumer Protection Act, if its financial impact is unfair, if you need protection, why Do you give it only to the small debt? It's a moral question. It's an ethical question. If it is bad to do this to the next man, to the biblical who is my neighbor, if it's bad and wrong to do it to one man, why not for somebody who has got practice over 100,000 francs or whatever the amount may be? So what happens in practice is the poor man is in debt, he's under threat, he's lost his job, he can't keep up with the payments. But he has no protection, because the debt he has on his house or on wherever it is over the limit which the minister said. For goodness sake, if something is unfair, it's unfair for all. If it's burdensome for some, make it for all. So what I'm really saying is the act is defective in its original state, because it excludes many contracts, many people. When it comes to the extent of protection, and again you must please allow me on just touching on the surface within the limited time. And this week we had it that interest rates go up by 0.5%. For the consumer, the maximum goes up by 1.1. Why? So that raises another question. If the contract is concluded while the repo rate is 8.5%, 5.5%, and now it increases, is the maximum applicable relative to the initial contract, or there you go along? It is something on which the action in the first place has stripped out the answer. It hasn't. It's not doing so now. From the point of view of availability of the process, of its success, I think there are reasons to approach things differently. I think what one should do is pick one topic. Let's say consent agreements. Now, this act is, in many respects, over-regulating. Let me tell you what, probably you know it, but let me just remind what happens, of course. You reach a...
What agreement did you say? We just couldn't hear you. The what?
On the court.
What agreement are you referring to?
Of consent agreement.
Right.
So, in the courts, the way it works is this. You reach an agreement, a contract of agreement, but you need not make it in order of court. A, it's not necessary. B, it entails expense. Now, what you... In this case, it's different. You have a consent agreement, but because a debt counsel is involved in terms of Supreme Court of Appeal decision, the counselor must draw a program and he must take it to the magistrate court. That costs money. Now, I see in the next presenter there is an example of this. The debt counsel says, it's very nice of you to come for debt construction, but give me 3,400 rand. I had it actually as 4,000 rand, because I must go to court. Now, we're dealing with a man who has no money. To you, to me, 100 rand is the price of a good meal in a restaurant. We're dealing with a man who already is out. Now, to tell him, he must pay 4,000 rand to have an agreement on which he agrees that intends to pursue it, is not in order. So I would think that one constructs the model accordingly as follows. You can reach an agreement with your creditor, and I'll come back to that to promote that. Because there's only one debt, it's a house bond. I lost my job. That's why I'm in my difficulty with a house bond. So your one section 129, which sends him all over the show for similar report and whatever, doesn't bring him to the simple thing of say, look, if you have a problem, come speak to me. Section 129 should have as first thing, if you have a problem or a dispute, come to me, we'll sort it out. And if not, overseas. If he goes to a consumer counselor, by the way, earlier, often understood as being a consumer, a debt counselor, canceller, instead of a debt counselor. People call to cancel this, and they can't do it. Perhaps says the object is to have the man pay it, pay all his debts within a reasonable time. So there's no writing off of debt under this act. There is a possibility which I think section 129 should also mention. Go to the magistrate court. Administration order. It's free. You pay on the installment, but it's free. Go there, you go have an instruction of debt. Now, let's get back to the agreement. All you have to say is, if there is a consent agreement, contract, and if the debtor does not comply, you will take the matter to the consumer court. To the tribunal. The tribunal and the NCA provides a clue to what was sought that you simply hand it in. It talks about filing an application, not lodging an application. In other words, put it over the counter, that's filing. I want an order because the man didn't comply, short affidavit. The tribunal is much cheaper. You also eliminate many counselors or attorneys. The temptation is there to go the court route, which is money for them, instead of the tribunal route, which is cheap. The act must open the way to the consumer to a tribunal cheaply. What in fact has happened is, again, the appeal court, I think, made a mistake. That's human. They let the one section as providing that you can... No, let me just go back. To this step, we must eliminate courts as far as we can, because they are expensive, they're slow, they are not so much better equipped. I also suggest that we eliminate other people. Now, let's step back for a moment on the question of the narrow scope of the NCA, where I said that only some people are health. At the moment, you can go to a magisterial administration order. That somehow has been neglected. There may be criticisms. But if you can't rectify it there, you're not going to rectify it here. Those same problems are going to stay here. Now, that act started with one section. One little section. When problems came up, the need for more, they amended and amended. It now runs from section 34, best quad ter, right through to about 27 sections. Now, this bill has one section which solves one problem, that's the death of a counselor. But the amendment of the reconstruction order is not catered for. Safety of the money, not catered for. For say an amendment of the order, the person says, look, I can't incur a new debt before I've paid all my debts and get a clearance certificate. Now I've paid all my other debtors, John and Peter and the other one. But my bond is a 20-year thing, it's a big amount I haven't. On this act, this man may not incur new debt until he's paid his bond fully. 20 years. You exclude him from ordinary trade. Reconstruction, we're dealing with a debt problem. Now, I've mentioned the possibility of the administration audit. There is the National Credit Act. There's voluntary agreement which is not encouraged by the Act, it's a written seal, come to me, we'll sort it out. And then you're left with marijuana. They don't get reconstruction of debt. All their debt may be without being reckless. All their debt may not justify a reconstruction order, because it can't be dealt with for a reasonable time. They never in their lifetime get through. Now, what must these people do? Now, can I give you a possible suggestion? It's not the only one. It's not necessarily the best one. What you need, that you'll have to cooperate with the Department of Justice, is to say to the employer, well, let me just come back to this. You can't ask people, as now been done, not to ask for, what do you call them, attached to the salary orders? Conscience orders. You can't ask Trevor to do something. My daughter lent an amount to a swim instructor of a kid who appears later to have been insolvent. And the only way you can get money out of that woman is monthly payments. You need a garnishee order. How can you ask her not to try and get the money? Now, she doesn't know about how many other garnishee orders there are, so everybody goes. But this is the employer where these things may take effect. He can be, by legislation, forced to say, if you get one garnishing order which causes less than or more than 40% of his family to be garnishee, refuse to register it, send it back to the applicant, and he can go to court. There, where bottom is, there you throttle it. Not systems, amendments of laws, bureaucratic overviews, discretions, just take it on the employer. When you come to too much credit, you also have some Chinese solution, something original. What they did is when the economy heated up, they didn't have systems and prohibitions except one. You can buy as many houses or businesses you like. But if you buy it in a bond, you may be speculating. So what we say is, one bond. Which means the man who has money can buy more, but you can't buy speculatively. Now, with the NCA, your imperative for the creditor is profit. But your banks do, they discovered this is so profitable that only 80% of the people pay. I can write off the rest because I still make sufficient money on this. Which means the interest rate they charge is high enough to make a profit. So when they discovered it, I went with such saying, a loan is easy, and that was a loan is easy, and everywhere you look, like that loans, please, take loans. Now, if in this act, the ministers, the maximum interest rate is not 3, but 25 or 22, I'm not suggesting a specific one. Then if the profits come down, you'll find the people less keen to do that type of business. Now, you can't stop being the bank business, but after all, this is not banking business. This is speculation. Banks are there to take my money and to lend it to the next person that they make that 3.5%. If they have a subsidiary doing this so that they can't affect the banking system, fine. But what has now happened, I think the Reserve Bank will ignore me if I'm on the wrong foot. I think they may have an input, or the banks may have input, in the fact that the consumer's protection on monetary level, which is the most important to him, is taken away. Previous to the NCA, you had a pitch to financing, which I'll demonstrate with an example. I go to a bank, I say to them, look, I don't really need overdrafts or anything. I never use them. But there may be the occasion where a check coming in appears to be late. So give me an overdraft facility, which I don't use. So the first thing, how much do you want? 10,000 rand. Okay. Who are you? What have you got? What do you do? Initiation fee, 150 rand. Now, I've never used a credit, but it's cost of a potential credit. Under the old act, usury act, it looked like the international model at the total cost of having credit. So you would look at everything, the credit that charges, his interest, what nobody else has. If you look at that total and it exceeds the interest rate, it's out, you don't pay it. The NCA has changed that. It says you can have your interest at the maximum rate, but you can have an initiation fee, you can have an administration fee, you can have life insurance. If the man pays early, you have a fee, although he's got millions that he's got in base, but the banks have been protected against that they exchange with the consumer. I don't think there's any rightfulness in this at all. They make lots of money, and they have sufficient room with a 3.5% to do decent money. And let's have a look at one something else which considers it. If you're a trader, you sell things, you keep books, you keep accounts, you do that for your own benefit, you pay. You do it for the receiver of revenue, you pay it. It's not the customer who pays it. When it comes to the financial institutions, they've incrementally come away with, I want a monthly fee, I want an annual fee on a credit card, although you don't use it, I want a raising fee, although you don't use it. I'm considering doing business with you so that I can take money, but you pay me for considering whether I do business with you. Insurance, fair insurance. Everybody is about a captive insurance company or a good friend. There is no control, really. All you know is that the consumer is going to pay more. I see no reason why the credit provider in form of financial institutions should not do the business at their own cost. Next time we'll hear that they charge, want to charge a fee for coming onto the premises, because you know, you have to hire premises and computers. And then of course we have to advertise, and I want the fee for looking at my advert. Look, this is ridiculous. But this is really the process of saying, I do something, you pay. Now, let me just look at, I'm just going to glance over some of the amendments in this bill. But before doing that, let me just explain two sessions. I do not know how the parliamentary procedures work, but from a reliable source, I've understood that after the bill has sort of come to the stage, it goes to the chamber.
I want you to continue, but I just want to advise you. Advise you.
Is my time up?
I said, I just want to advise you. Well, you will have to complete this in 7 minutes. 7 minutes. That's a lot of time, as you know.
Thank you. All right, I have to skip very quickly then. Section 129. I believe it is one of those where Parliament's procedures interfere. They said enforcement of a court in a court. If you take those words away, then Section 129 is, in good English, a warning. It is now, and is being amended to be, a duplication of 130, which already says you can't come to court without. So we don't need it. But we've missed the point of 129. 129 was a warning. He said, my dear friend, you're in trouble, you haven't paid. If there's a problem, go here, there, or there, or there, or sort it out. Now, I suggest that 129 be brought back to enforcement. Judges have a lot of saying about the word enforcement, peculiar word for cancellation,
that sort of thing. It's unjust harshness and fresh harsh criticism as always. What Saint-Denis should do is, I'm writing to you because you're in arrears. If you have a problem, come to me. If you have a dispute, find somebody, so and so. But it is now at the moment, without thinking there's a dispute, go to that counselor. He's not paid for that, his fees is not controlled for that, it's not his work to settle disputes. If you want to approach him, you go to the 86 route, not for a specific contract. You tell him to go to the consumer court. They are unconstitutional, as I think Nadal is held, and I think the Cape. I had a hearing with him, I tell you, it is horrific based. They cannot attend to a dispute or redistribution of debt because their work is only for a business practice. So we're telling now the man, go to a place where you won't be helped. We're telling him to go to an ombudsman of the jurisdiction without telling him what it is, and he won't know it's only to go to a bank. Or go to a mediator. None of those will respond within 10 days. This advice must be reworked, it must be something different and not a duplication of anything. Let me in the last second to pick up air. There are other defects in this, too many to mention. One of these is that the tribunal can declare a contract reckless. Now, the tribunal is cases of supervision. The debt consultant didn't do this, this didn't do that, you act against them. Or a complaint from the consumer. But they told the complaints I didn't get an account. The operating section says when a credit agreement is before a court. Now that phrase, when it is before the court, that gives you lots of uncertainty. Is it only when it's a cause of action, or is it, if some mention is made of it, or if you, in solvency proceedings, there's a reference to the line debts. Now that word doesn't come before the tribunal. They cannot accept for an investigation, and then that's at the Pretoria, and the consideration of excess debt is a cut down with the dealers and where the tribunal is. It is not a place for them. But, Chairperson, I'm bleeding to cut to the section which says if you're not registered, the contract is void. Now, what is the reason for that section? That section doesn't look whether I am innocent or guilty, knowing that I'm wrong. You have this man with the 70 million dollars to his friend in the Cape. They sat in Namibia over a beer and said, look, 7 million I'll lend to you. He didn't think he's a credit provider. Nor did I think I was a credit provider when I gave my daughter a loan to fly down to a funeral. It's innocent people who walk into a trap. The section doesn't look at whether their debt is bad for the economy or whether it's good for the economy. It has no interest in fair, unfair, good or bad. It only sees you register. Now, in my book, that is bureaucracy taken to a different point. There are other remedies. You say within a year, at the moment says a court can do this. It doesn't come before the court if the consumer doesn't know there. So the poor person doesn't know he goes to court, and a few people will get some of the protection. Now, in this law, sections A and B are deleted. Now, I invite you to look at that section, delete A and B, and see how the main portion ends. It reads, semicolon and. That and is the remnant of the old act, it's not even removed. The remedy is for the court to decide what it is fit. Now, looking at America, you'll find a precedent for anything, because the one judge is out of bounds with what he wants to do. And quite honestly, when I read that,
But look, the Department of Trade and Industry do not know what really to put in there, so they said, let the judge decide. It is not the desire of the proposition. Punish the man with loss of a quarter of his interest, which is all that made the difference, or allow the NCR to do something. Now, let me just last on this, point out the discrimination. The Act does not diminish the common law principle that I do not have to perform unless you perform. So if the contract is void and the consumer comes to me and says, you said you lent me 100,000 RON, I'll just say, thank you, the contract is void, my friend. Contract 100,000 for 2% to study. Go to somebody who will charge you 8%, because it's void, I'll escape it. So John Shovalala goes to the conscript to buy goats for the ceremony. And the seller sells the goats, but he says, I haven't got sufficient money. Seller says, right, but you'll have to pay me interest because I'm paying money. So the buyer says, yes, I pay interest, but now the contract is void. Because like all innocents, he doesn't know about the deed, he doesn't want to go for quarterly returns, annual returns, payments, fees, application forms which he doesn't know where to find. So he burdened protection of the consumer. Protection of the consumer. Now the seller comes back against the consumer and says, look, there's an engagement claim. Those goats that I bought you because you're family and the ceremony is not unrelated to me, I gave you the goods at half price. Now that it's enrichment, you give me the full value, my friend. Or the buyer cannot get the credit anywhere. Tells me, he gets the credit from this man. Employer or whatever doesn't think I'm a credit granter. It's just completely out of place. If they want some sort of thing for administration, devise it. But don't tap a man's rights. Loss for one, loss for all. Close down one man's business, less employment, less money in circulation.
No, thank you very much, Judge. Thank you.
We'll write another book another day.
No, we are going to study what you have said. I hope that you raise questions in the actual submission. And as you presented it here and submitted it here this morning, you gave these issues with examples and proposals. We find that very constructive, that approach. And maybe we could ask you to spend a little bit more time back home, as it were, and just readjust your submission in that particular manner. Because your principles first, and then these proposals with what you have identified within the amendment bill. Because that is exactly how we want to approach it. Members, I am calling for tea now. However, when we come back, Judge Lane, you'll be sitting there to take questions, please. Alright? So we're taking a very short tea break of 7 to 10 minutes. Thank you. So, it's a question of raising one's hands now. Right. Bear in mind, we've asked the judge to come back with a submission that encapsulates the points he made. Honorable Hill Lewis, Honorable Swanepoel, Honorable Baines. Oh, entering, right. Right, so we've got two people asking questions. Anyone else? No. Right, that's it. Starting with yourself, Honorable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much to Judge Fleming. It really was a wonderful presentation and a very unique insight with so much experience. A couple of questions. Firstly, I support the comments that the chairperson made. It would be really useful if you could do a little bit more detail in your submission. I hope that you can hear me. Can you hear me, Judge? Okay, are you struggling to hear us?
The question will be followed up with Ms. Hurley next to the judge. So I'll click with
you. All right, okay. I was saying the presentation is useful, but it would be great if you could make more specific reference to the amendments that you seek. Then I wanted to ask you about an example of a credit consumed statement, which we saw yesterday, in which a judge had granted an emolument attachment order, even though the amount is far in excess, more than double what the in duplum limited amount should have been. And I wanted to ask you why that happens in the court. Why is there no attention given by the courts to the details of the case when there is an application for an emolument attachment order before it? Or garnishee order? Why is it allowed to happen that when a statement of account is so manifestly incorrect, the garnishee order is still awarded? That's the first question. The second question is the comment that you made about the interest rates. I really agree with your comment that there's no good reason why a 0.5% increase in the repo rate should result in a 1.1% increase in the maximum applicable to most unsecured credit, which impact on the poor worse than anyone else. And I wondered whether you thought, the debate has been raised in this committee in the last couple of days about whether this should be dealt with in the bill itself or whether it should be left up to regulation. And one of our presenters yesterday felt very strongly that maxima should be defined specifically in the bill, or at least a formula for the maxima, if not the maxima themselves. And I wondered what your comments on that were.
Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Slot.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Judge Fleming, thank you very much for that input. I found it very, very useful. Just one quick one. You shared with us the fact, you just highlighted again the fact that the full debt has to be repaid before you can get debt again, and that's including the mortgage bonds, which could take 20 years, which will take a lender out of the market for 20 years, which is absurd. I was wondering whether, when you do your submission as the chairperson of, if you could just look at that specific clause and possibly give us a remedy, how the wording can work to exclude bonds from it.
Thank you, Honourable Kwanapu. Just a few comments from the General Council of SOG here. The Deputy Governor has left behind Johan Zayoka. Briefly, thank you.
Honourable Chair, I just want to make a few statements, and maybe what has been said before. I'm just maybe reiterating some of that, but what one must bear in mind is that previously, under the dispensation that actually is, that we actually adhere to at the moment, we have, as the Deputy Governor has explained, we have banks being regulated by the South African Reserve Bank from a prudential viewpoint. In other words, what we're trying to do is to see that when deposits, and remember banks fund their business with depositors' funds, we want to see that those funds that banks collect actually flows back to them after they've done the business. But it's also prudential requirements that say that banks must also hold their own capital. So they can't only do business with just deposits from the general public. There are rules about this. We follow international standards set by the Basel Committee in Basel, Switzerland, and this is for us to be able to, on a global basis, do banking. Now, this new dispensation, that's called Twin Peaks, that was explained this morning, has an additional angle now. Remember, prudential, you regulate the prudential side of banks. You're now also going to get the regulation of the conduct of banks. So now what is going to happen is, once this new financial sector regulation bill, which is at this point in time has been approved by cabinet, yes, once that comes into operation, if it comes into operation, and I have no doubt it will, it will then lend another angle to banking, and it will mean that their conduct will also be regulated by a different, by the other piece of the 20s. So maybe all these issues that we are talking about now will be caught up there, because it's going to provide a much better sort of situation whereby these other things may be addressed. Just my short comments on this?
No, thank you very much. Although a bird in the hand is worth several in the bush, I judge.
Elucidating comments, obviously, I don't should be regarded as a question, but I would like to see high-risk business to go to own funds, etc., than to a separate story. Don't expose the consumer like Sambo, like Lehman and the others to banks wanting to make big money. Garnishy order, why is it made? I never read newspaper reports on court proceedings because you invariably found that something frequently key to the decision is not mentioned. I'm not aware of this case. The why, it is not abnormal for a court to make an order which you simply do not know why. That's why we need an appeal system. So I would hardly be able to condemn or justify that without having some detail about it. But there is one thing one should bear in mind. Civil court is bound to decide what the parties place before it. So if something is not put in issue, the court does not attend to that. If, for instance, the debtor comes, let me just call the administration court to say, these are my debts. The court doesn't go into the question of, are you right? Is one not prescribed? Were you not a minor? It's not looking for defenses. What is put place before it as an issue is what the court attended. So it may look as if it is blaringly overlooking something, while in fact it is simply not on the table. Whether it should be on the table, that's a different issue. Parties often refuse to take a certain point because there are other interests. If it doesn't suit their other interests or the dispute escalates too wise, so they come to court only on one issue and say, decide this issue for us. So there may be various considerations, but an answer simple sentence, I'm afraid I cannot give on a specific case. The race in the bill, no, provided, or it can be outside the bill, but I think not in the bill. Let me give you the history of interest rates on real lower rates. It used to be a long-term 3.5% because the banks do not look at short-term things. Let's say if you invest money, over a long term you get 3.5%. But when it comes to debtor and credit from day to day, that is unrealistic. Because debtor and credit is a question of months. If you don't give me more money, I'll come back and ask how you double. So there was an application in the Free State Court to increase the motor rates, and they said 6.5%. But rates at that stage is something like 20%. So the government passed legislation and said in terms of that rate of interest, the minister can set rate. Now, he said that it's 15.5%. Which means that my best investment I can make in this world is a debtor who is in arrears, but who will eventually pay. Because I'm going to get 15.5% interest tax-free. It's compensatory interest, not remunerative interest. But now that becomes unfair, because if you want to bring 15.5% down to 7 or 8%, or in 2 years time down 1%, you have to come to Parliament, and nobody takes initiative. This 15.5% has been standing now for about 20 years, ever since our interest high inflation times. Nobody lowers it. Now, put it in the regulations, then you depend upon the activity of the minister. And I can quote you many examples where the minister simply does not come around to acting from day to day. I'm against all new sort of new systems, but perhaps there should be a way, an annual report internally, diary for the minister. What does the reserve bank tell me? What is fair now for a rate? But it doesn't work as good as it works for the statute unless you have people actively thinking, applying that thing. So, no firm views. There is a question about the full bond. Paying off the bond and you still have to wait for 15 or 20 years. I think it links to what I've said previously. Your Majesty's Court 74 has a provision for amending the order. This NCA has not. Now, it creates an intolerable position. It creates that people often, in fact, do things just to have the state system work. So you find the introduction of payment agents. It's totally unlawful, despite one court decision. Now there's an attempt to make it lawful. But the things that need regulation, which you can foresee, must be provided for. Your debt counselor may find himself too ill. Now it says he must do all sorts of things. But he cannot choose a debt counselor for the next, to follow him. The choice of a debt counselor is that of the consumer. So what happens? You need something different from what the world provides at the moment. You must tell the consumer there's a problem, choose somebody else. But the debt counselor may die. Then he can't comply with this act. He can't give this assurance and that statement and that affidavit. But the situation needs an entity. But what I foresee, to come back to your answer, is that should be able, the consumer must be able to come back, unfortunately it may have to be to court, to say, look, my position was bad, but now my wife has got the job, I've paid up all my debts, so please cancel it, or please change it, I'll probably cancel it, I'll come right with the creditor. The bank or building society is happy with it. So just cancel the order and we'll carry on with an arrangement. But I think that's the direction of change. It is making it a more pliable structure by providing for more eventualities than the one single, no, 1.5 clause. Thank you.
We'd like to thank you very much, Judge Fleming. We've already spoken, and we will be in further contact with you. Thank you very much indeed. Now, members, very difficult to cut some of these things short when very constructive input being made on the Reserve Bank as well as Judge Fleming. Let's ask Ms. Arde from Personal Finance to just make a swift presentation here. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, honourable members, stakeholders and members of the public, it's my privilege to have been invited to address you today. I'm a reporter at Personal Finance newspaper. I've been covering credit for the past 2 years. For this submission, I'll share with you two cases of consumer abuse reported to me this year. Over the past 2 years, I've heard many appalling stories, but the following two highlight some of the problems that the National Credit Amendment Bill doesn't address or perhaps does not sufficiently address. I'll then make some suggestions as to how these problems could be addressed. I've not dealt with all of the areas in your invitation, Madam Chair, only those that I can confidently speak to. So the cases involve a client, one of the big four banks, and apparently a victim of reckless lending. And the other involves women in debt counselling, a kind of, if not the biggest debt counselling firm, one of the biggest. Both consumers are single mothers and relatively empowered in that they are educated and heavy enough to have turned to media for help. They do not represent the majority of consumers of credit, people who are economically vulnerable and very literate, if not illiterate. I believe such people don't stand a chance in the face of abuse by a bank or a credit or a debt counsellor. And empowered as these two consumers are, neither of them have a firm grasp of their rights in terms of the National Credit Act. Mrs. S.K. went to her bank on the 2nd of December last year to apply for a home loan to replace windows in a house that she inherited. She needed 60,000 rand. The bank's consultant told her it would take about 3 months for a bond to be registered and advised her to take out a personal loan in addition to her home loan. The consultant advised Mrs. S.K. that as soon as the home loan was granted, she could use the funds to pay off the personal loan. The consultants also advised the consumer to take up a revolving credit facility of 28,000 rand for emergencies. Mrs. S.K. agreed to this, but said she was emphatic that she could not afford repayments of 2,600 rand a month on personal loan, and I quote, "I expressly told her," the consultant, "that I cannot afford that, and she said I mustn't worry, because once the finance is available..."
Here, which doesn't appear to be the same as what you've got.
What you have, there's a truncated version of what I'm reading, but I can give you a copy of this.
It is so truncated, I don't have those figures.
Okay,
thanks.
I will provide it. Sure. So the consumer's denying that she's saying that she expressly told a consultant that she couldn't afford repayments of 2,600 rand a month, and the consultants assured her not to worry when the finance for the home loan comes through, she can settle the 60,000 rand personal loan. The bank's quotation shows that the first installment on the personal loan is due on the 25th of February, about 3 months from the date of application, which is how long it takes to register a bond, she was told. So Mrs. S.K. accepted the personal loan of 60,000 rand and the revolving credit limit of 28,000 rand and simultaneously, with the help of the same consultant, applied for a home loan. The personal loan was paid out the following day and the revolving credit facility was made available to her. But 5 weeks later, she was informed that her application for a home loan was declined due to affordability constraints. And she asked, "If I cannot afford approximately 1,500 rand a month for a home loan, how on earth can I afford 2,600 rand a month for a personal loan?" Mrs. S.K. never touched the 60,000 rand in her account, and nor did she make use of the revolving credit facility that the bank gave her. Since the bank's plan, or the plan hatched by the bank, failed, she returned the 60,000 rand to the bank. But the bank is demanding from her a settlement amount of 4,028 rand for accrued fees, charges and interest. She doesn't have 4,028 rand and is fearful that the bank will proceed against her. She phones the National Credit Regulators Call Centre to lodge a complaint and is told that she should take her complaint to the Banking Ombudsman. The Banking Ombudsman, however, cannot deal with matters of reckless lending. Personal Finance sent questions to her bank. In response, it denies the customer's claims, and in particular the allegation that credit was granted recklessly. The bank has prudence, affordability and credit criteria, and the customer's application was assessed according to these. According to the bank's quotation agreement, Mrs. S.K.'s declared expenses amount to 6,000 rand a month. She told Personal Finance she does not know how the consultant arrived at that figure. My expenses come to 13,000 and that's before buying food. If Mrs. S.K. was a reckless borrower, she would have used the personal loan and she would be in an extremely precarious financial position now. By her own admission, the repayments on the home loan would have pushed her into a debt trap. The BEFR and our Quick Finance Ombuds, Nulintu Bam, referring to financial service providers, unleashing untrained, unsupervised and unqualified people on the public, and the results are devastating for the individual, families and the economy at large. I believe that the National Credit Amendment Bill needs to issue binding affordability regulations. Clearly guidelines are not enough. The bill is correct to allow for binding affordability regulations. Prohibit credit providers from mis-selling credit products to consumers. The employees of credit providers should not be allowed to give credit advice without proper training and regulatory oversight. Even if they have the appropriate face-type NGO training, they should not be incentivized on credit acceptances because this creates an inherent conflict of interest. The bill should address this by prohibiting mis-selling. The amendment bill should empower the NCR to investigate cases of reckless lending of their own accord or when approached by consumers so that consumers can get redress. The bill has a provision to enable the regulator to do so. And the amendment bill needs to make provision for the cancellation of an unused credit facility at a nominal fee. The second case study involves Ms. L, a 55-year-old single mother. When she was retrenched in August 2012, she had significant debt. Unemployed for almost a year, she lived off the goodwill of her extended family. In June 2013, she managed to find a job as a personal assistant, earning 5,000 rand a month. Her pension of parent and her daughter helped support her. In July 2013, she applied for debt counselling. The debt counselling company found her over indebted and took her on as a client. Ms. L has 5 credit agreements and debt amounting to 70,500. 4 months after being found eligible for debt counselling, Ms. L received her proposal. It is signed by her and states that her income is 9,000 rand. When questioned by personal finance as to the discrepancy between her income as per the proposal and what she told us she earned, she said she was told by the consultant employed by the debt counselling company that it was the only way the proposal would work, unquote. Personal finance asked Ms. L if she was ever asked by the debt counselling firm for proof of income, and she said the company has a copy of her salary slip. Of her 5 creditors, 3 have agreed to the proposal. Of the 2 that have rejected it, one is a large clothing retailer owed 537 rand. The store rejected the proposed installments of 51 rand a month and would not budge on the interest rate of 21%, but was willing to extend the repayment term from 12 months to 15. The other creditor that rejected the proposal was one of the big banks, which is owed 6,500. The proposal made provision for repayments of 214 rand a month, but the bank won 372. Going through the proposal with Ms. L, personal finance pointed out to her that if she could eliminate the smallest debt of 537 rand, not only would that rid her of a creditor that is rejecting the proposal, but it would also enable her to reallocate the money earmarked for that debt to paying bank, which could potentially starve off termination by the other creditor rejecting the proposal. She immediately saw the sense in that, and within a week had sold all the furniture lying around her house and paid off one of her smallest debts. She subsequently informed the debt counselling company that she'd paid off her clothing account and wanted the extra money to go to the bank. Meanwhile, the debt counselling company is pressing her for a legal sundry fee of 6,500 rand. Ms. L says she has no recollection of being informed about this fee, yet the signature is on supporting affidavit, which clearly spells out her liability for legal fees. Aside from the debt counselling firm having unlawfully overstated her income, there are other concerning things about Ms. L's experience of debt counselling. The first is the absence of any actual counselling in the process. Ms. L admits that she's no good with money. She says she was hoping that debt counselling would literally provide her with a form of counselling, or at the very least, a dedicated debt counsellor who would, if not help her budget, teach her how to manage money. But every time I phone, I have to speak to someone different at the call centre, she says. It's humiliating and frustrating having to tell my story over and over every time I call. And they aren't concerned about my finances. They even told me all they are looking at is my debt. Unquote. Ms. L has a DSTV subscription, a TIN contract, and a cell phone subscription. Being released from a cell phone subscription may come at a cost, but she could make an instant saving if she gave up the luxury of her gym membership and DSTV subscription. But no such conversations have been had between her and the debt counsellor. The second concerning thing is incessant harassment by her credit providers. Ms. L gets regular calls, SMSs, and emails from another of her creditors, a clothing retailer, a high-end supermarket that offers Visa cards. They're demanding money from her, and this is a creditor that has accepted the proposal. He explained to me that regardless of me being in debt counseling, he will continue to ask me for money. I told him to speak to my debt counselor. He said that's not how it works. It's our right to call you, and we will continue to call you. And on Monday of this week, that credit provider handed her account over to a debt collector. And then the apparent non-disclosure of legal fees, and so it came to signing the supporting affidavit. Ms. O has told her debt counseling firm that she cannot afford to pay $3,500 for legal fees. In response, she was told, I will inform our legal department that you are unable to afford our legal fees. This sounds to me mildly threatening, very much like being handed over by your debt counselor. When she asked for a breakdown of her legal sundry fees, she got a detailed response, which you will get. Ms. L has already paid her debt counseling fee of 2,074 rand, and she's now liable for the legal fees of 3,500 rand. And is being hounded by debt collectors. Is she really better off? This case shows that debt counselors must face stiff penalties or be deregistered where they present debt repayment proposals that are fraudulent or simply designed to result in acceptance of some credit providers. Debt counselors should be required to have face-to-face meetings with consumers in which they properly explain all fees, and debt counselors and debt counseling and legal fees should be limited and paid on the consumer's monthly debt repayment amount, along with all other credit providers. In other words, be paid on a pro rata basis. Debt counselors should be required to complete a detailed budget with the consumer, with the aim of assisting consumers to decrease their expenses so as to find more money to repay debt. Credit providers should be forced to provide all consumers in debt counseling with a copy of their monthly account statements showing the receipts of the monthly installments. And debt and payment distribution agents should be obliged to ensure that consumers in debt counseling are sent a monthly distribution statement. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Arda, Angelica Arda, for that, on personal finance. Yes, it is a matter of great concern when someone is in debt, having it increased to the point which puts them further into debt, and the apparent collusion between the debt, review person counselor and a debt collector. Let's see by show of hands those who agree. Comment or raise a question. Honourable Abasa. Honourable Kadebe.
Thanks, Comrade Chair. I wish to express gratitude at the input that has been made. The angle in which Ms. Arda comes is also appreciated because it shows that she is close to the consumers. It's also so that you are able to speak in DA. It also shows empathy. I just wanted to make that broad point and keep up the good work. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Mabaza. Honourable Kadebe.
So I also concur with my colleague that this is one of the brilliant presentations we had.
because it gives a practical experience of what the ordinary consumer is experiencing on the ground. I also appreciate the fact that Maharte is calling for the chief benefit, in particular for the deaf counselor. As I read previously when the regulator was with us here, that what happens to the deaf counselors when they drop their clients? Sometimes they will just leave their clients. There's one in my constituency, I referred one of my constituents to a deaf counselor. Not 2 months down the line, they had taken a case, but she was just dropped like that. During that time, all the legal studies coming to her. But what is happening here is the corporate culture of South Africa is relaxed, is more in favor of the big business than the small person on the street. So what I want to suggest here is that Radio Man push for, will the lady agree with us that the CEOs of this company must take personal responsibility, because they come to us here, speak one language, they go to their employees, do something different. As I said to the other teacher, the issue of pushing this relative lending is done from the top. Those people who are there giving credit, they are given targets that within this month you must have to ensure that so many millions are already committed. So then what they say here and what happens on the other side is something different. But if, because that one is the corporate culture, if they pay someone who's in charge is held accountable, I think then that the things will go down. Because Shepherd, remember those chairs, which are very quick, Concord, those who fly from England to America within a few hours. The person designed those planes was called, that engineer was called out of retirement when there was that accident in Paris, out of retirement and prosecuted. So what was great about that is that they took it to the individual man who came with that. So we'll share a few with us that really we have to not only register, but what we suggest is that if they, because the strength which the customer goes through cannot even be measured, so that if any liability where the case was pushed must be taken by the state counselor. Would you agree with us? Because what is the just register? It's fine, but the damage is in that. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Hudebi. I have sent an email to me which I've advised the person to send it to the committee secretary. But for similar such cases, and one of the points made was people, you know, if a person goes, they're left owing only 350 rand at some fashion house or other. And when this was put together, they are owed 500 rand automatically, although they were only in arrears 2 months. So I said, no, let's just get that more detailed. But one must agree that this incentivization on credit amounts to reckless lending. All these ads and the SMSs that someone was referring to earlier, probably the Reserve Bank. And we cannot allow rogues in this sector from actually increasing their power in this area. And I was thinking of this whole act, and what this amounts to is a form of social genocide that is legal. And we're going to stop it right here and now. I'm very interested in finding out constructive points. What are these constructive proposals that are coming forth here? And I don't believe when we address this that that's going to have an adverse impact on prudent banking. If you are being prudent, what are you getting into this for? Thank you. No, please respond. No. Yes. There were two questions raised there.
Sorry, Honourable Mabaza. Sorry. I absolutely agree on your point about personal accountability of CEOs of these companies and good providers. Absolutely. We'd like to see people being held to account for their actions.
And we really welcome the inputs that have been made here. I think the Honourable Advisor has said already that
the work that you're doing, and also what Honourable Khadevi has said, indicates that you have a clarity of understanding of the consumer. But you did indicate that these would probably be in the region of low to middle income, that's how I understood it. And my one appeal to personal finance, broadly speaking, is to try and open that reflection, that journalistic analysis and reflection, to below that market somewhat, because these are the greatest victims at the moment. And we welcome you coming here this morning and sharing that with us, and if we can get the detailed submission. Thank you. Members, we are moving very quickly now, and we're going on to Wonga, is it? Wonga Finance? Wonga, I'm just looking at the name. Kevin Herbert. You called it out, I can't read them.
With Mr. Hoaches, with Mr. Chong and Dan Cohen.
Right, we can have the three of you here, and I'm certain that Mr. Kevin Herbert will be making the presentation or the submission, talking to us. Thank you. We can do that also quite efficiently. And members, I know we're all under pressure for one reason or another, so let's move on.
I hope that you've still got the patience to, after a long week, and I think I'm last on the agenda. So true, what I have to say. But thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chair, and allowing us to present today. Just to highlight some of the objectives of our submission and presentation, we're aware of numerous perceptions about our product and our service, and I think that it is important for me to address these, but particularly in the context of us representing quite a different aspect of credit division than those that you would have heard from previously, in that we represent the move from the analog world to the digital world. And I think generally across the world there's a challenge around legislation to accept and to move towards more of a digital staunch rather than what we've seen in the past, which is purely analog. So as a general backdrop to this, I'm quite interested in that discussion, because this is what we represent. Our business is 100% and purely online, and I don't think there's another credit provider in this country that has a similar model. We have a great deal of respect for the National Credit Act, as well as the process to reform and amend parts of it. And yes, my aim is to engage the key drivers of these reforms and to work together towards a common solution. And I think I've had the opportunity also to have insight into credit legislation in other parts of the world, both developed and developing markets. And I can honestly say that, you know, I give a lot of credit to this Act in terms of what we've seen since 2008 and its contribution to our quick recovery. So, you know, we certainly have that respect. You know, what I'd like to do is, you know, to a link between some of the objectives that have been set in the other submissions. We've spoken about combating over-indebtedness, we've spoken about reckless lending, and trying to translate that into a measure that is real and pragmatic for credit providers. Yeah, and our contention is that an arrears rate is, you know, not to oversimplify, but an excellent measure around what is actually happening at a credit provider. So, you know, from an audit perspective, if I was the National Credit Regulator, one of the first things I would look at is real arrears rate. And what do I mean by that? If I've lent 100 Rand in October, what principal, what of that 100 Rand have I been able to recover? You know, that gives an excellent indication in my mind as to where to start in terms of issues related to, you know, the practices of a particular credit provider. And we believe that this is a practical metric to measure proposed amendments' potential effect in combating over-indebtedness. So very simply, again, you know, I acknowledge that other stakeholders will have a different view, but the way that we look at the amendment bill is to quite simply have a look at our own arrears rate and try and give some input into what impact that amendment or that clause would have on the arrears rates, obviously with the idea of driving that down. Again, I'm very aware that we have to differentiate between providers, credit providers that are legitimately trying to comply with the Act and those that are simply non-compliant and using very negative methods to try and collect money. In other words, those that don't really care about any kind of legislation or the consumer for that matter. So, in light of how I've just introduced, I think it is important just to spend some time talking about a company, and particularly this move of financial services to a purely online and digital space, where there is no offline. So, from where we see the digital finance as a future, and I think it's quite interesting to note, because again, this is some misperception, the company was started in 2006 in the UK by two South Africans, okay, who were living in the UK at the time. But they had a vision to create the world's leading digital finance company. And, you know, sitting down and looking at the existing landscape, there were a couple of things that really bothered us. The one, and I think we've referenced that in the previous conversation, was the incentive of agents to grant credits. So that was the first case study, and a lot of that case study goes down to the agents actually being incentivized. We didn't like that. The lack of transparency was a key issue, and I think remains a key issue within financial services. And we have been responsible for changing that, not nearly enough, but many of even banks have copied our idea of being very transparent on the cost of credit, even before an application process. But really, what we found, where we found ourselves was at a cusp of a changing worldwide landscape to the digital environment. I don't think that can be evasive. Our own lives every day, it is much more digital than it used to be. But also general dissatisfaction with the financial services sector, particularly around key issues like service, like lack of transparency, where we have seen these moves to digital in other sectors, but the financial service sector was being left behind in that regard. We launched in South Africa in 2012, just to provide some context. So everyone, you know, no matter what their income bracket, experiences situations where they need a small amount of cash to meet a short-term need. I think that's very important. Traditional financial services couldn't meet this need for small, fast loans, and that's quite important. When you have an emergency, you need the cash as soon as possible. You know, systems were built on long-term loans and running credit. Generally, there was the employment of highly complex bureaucratic processes with reams of fine print and extreme opaque fee structures. In fact, just this morning, I was trying to find the unauthorized credit card overdraft rate. Obviously, it's different from being banked, and I challenge the committee to do the same. It's simply not easy. So, just to kind of put that into visual context, you know, the mainstream need for credit moves between variable outgoings, mostly fixed net income, and then discretionary cash at certain times throughout the year. And I think ours is really a revolutionary approach. We have embraced the idea of technology and data. We're essentially data junkies. We believe that in this instance, machine and machine learning make much better credit decisions than humans do. Obviously, that is dependent on good data. And again, having experience of other countries, there is no shortage of good data in South Africa. Obviously, this can always be improved, but as a base, we have excellent data and data records and data availability. This slide is really there to indicate transparency of where the cost of credit is shown before application. And that actually moves depending on how the customer actually, what the customer chooses and the term that they choose. So it's dynamic, in other words. Prescribed interest rates and fees. Our interest is charged in line with those prescribed in Chapter 5 of the National Credit Act. As you'll know, there are 7 areas to that act, and we fall very specifically into the short-term credit transactions, which is at 5% per month, or translated into our language, 0.17% per day. Our average loan term is 23 days, just to give you context. I found it quite interesting. The Treasury presentation, I believe, on Tuesday had very, very interesting proposals, but I think it did a disservice in talking about payday lenders. And I think there was, it creates huge confusion, particularly the media articles that followed from that. I think we should just abandon the term payday lenders. There is provision for short-term credit transactions within our existing Act, and there are either credit providers or there are loan sharks. Continuing with the prescribed fees, in addition to the interest, just for reference, there is an initiation fee that is added to that, again, described by the Act. We fall very clearly under short-term credit transactions, which is a loan of no more than 8,000 Rand, no more than 6 months. Right, the idea of responsible lending, and, you know, I think it's very clear what the Honourable Member was saying earlier, that it is up to credit providers to question their own practices around responsible lending. I'll give you some ideas to what we are doing around that. But first some context. So, you know, we are making money when a loan is repaid, okay? And I'd like to draw that comparison to a credit card, okay? The philosophy behind a credit card is that that provider is actually not comfortable with you repaying that credit card in full. They would like you to pay some of the money, but actually to roll it and get deeper and longer in credit. That's how they make more money. We have a different philosophy to that, and there's some education around that. Okay? We, on a loan that is granted, and we'll talk more about that, we want that consumer to pay that loan back in full before being able to get another loan. And I think that's in absolute contrast to something like a credit card and some of the other products that are out there. We fund the loans ourselves. We are incentivized to make accurate lending, okay, decisions. And I think this is a differentiator here. We access thousands of pieces of data. In South Africa, we're up to about 5,000 pieces of data on each individual application, including that from credit bureaus, to assess risk using complex algorithms, okay? All machine learning. We only allow customers to take one loan at a time. Once they have repaid their loan in full, they are welcome to reapply. We accept 25% of applications, declining the remaining 75%. Our arrears numbers, very importantly, are in single digits, and again, as a metric, I'll talk about a potential case study, but I would like to challenge some of the lenders who currently do manual verification In a case study and a comparison to our arrears rate, we do not offer credit life insurance as part of our short-term loans, and I will talk a little bit more about that as well. We freeze interest at 90 days in arrears. Okay, I'm going to repeat that because that's quite unusual. We freeze interest at 90 days in arrears. To us, there is no point in continuing to charge interest on a consumer who has demonstrated an inability to repay any amount of that loan within a 3-month period. We do not continue to charge the prescribed 15.5% interest on customers in debt review. So when a customer is in debt review, we charge 0% interest. Again, my challenge is to find credit providers who do that. We audit external debt collection agencies, including legal, okay? And we are deliberate and specific in our use of EOOs and this statement are categorizing arrears into 3 distinct areas. And I'll just highlight for you our view on that. An arrears customer who is willing to engage with us as part of our arrears process, I can categorically tell you will not land up in an EAO. In other words, they are willing to discuss what the issues are and come to an arrangement. The second is what I call bank-assisted fraud in form of chargeback, which I think is a real problem in this country, where a legitimate loan may have been taken. Money is collected, but the following day, the borrower will go to the bank and reverse the collection. The bank's typical practice is for no questions to be asked. They don't request a mandate from the credit provider. And this is simply fraud. There's no other word for it. And we are quite harsh on that. We bypass all collections processes, other collection processes, and go straight to legal. The third category is where we go through our arrears collection process and the customer is unwilling to engage with us. Okay? That will typically go through a 60 to 90 day process of engagement using different forms of communication, which if we are still unsuccessful, will then go to EAO. Right, just to give you some idea of our customers, all of our customers have a transactional bank account with a history, all are employed and have a regular income, all have a history on credit bureau. Customers fall typically into an SM group 6 to 10, so again, we are not servicing, contrary to perception, the low income groups. Our loans are used as a short-term solution to a short-term cash flow problem. Our customers are part of the so-called Facebook generation, and access to the internet is a critical part of the process. Prior to our entry into the market, it was almost impossible for a customer or a consumer to access a loan of 1,800 rand for 20 days, as example. My contention was easier to get a loan of 10 million rand than it was to get 1,800 rand to meet an emergency need.
We can go from skip the common misperception that's very well laid out and go straight to Wonga.com submission,
right,
in respect of the National Credit Amendment Bill. Thanks.
Okay. So again, to reiterate, we leave credit advisor to the growth of the economy. We are respectful of the role of the NCA and those parts of amendments to it, and we remain committed to complying with the National Credit Act. The affordability assessment guidelines are particularly problematic for us because particularly clause 5.1 and 5.2 in our world is a step backwards to purely analog. So it talks about the manual verification. And again, you know, we are a digital company that processes loans 100% online. So in other words, there is no person that sits between the customer applying for a loan and being granted a loan if they are successful or being declined that loan. So that would require a complete change in our business model for the negative, and in my mind, a step back from innovation and technology advances. So we would require electronic access to data in support of these clauses. Physical scan supporting documents require manual verification, which is not supported as part of an electronic digital process right now. In addition, from a customer point of view, I think it involves the customer having to access specialized electronic equipment, fax service scanners, which obviously are both costly and reduce the availability and access credits for the said consumer. But more importantly than that, you know, there's no hard empirical evidence that says that manual verification results in lower arrears rate than online verification. And our submission is that, you know, or our recommendation rather, that we would suggest a case study be conducted comparing the arrears rate of an online credit provider, such as Wonga, with that of a lender who uses omitted documents and manual verification means when assessing affordability and credit risk. And we would be happy to participate in such a case study. Again, I might be saying the same thing, that to comply with 4.5.2, the customer would need to submit the required supporting documents and the provider would have to manually verify it. Our suggestion in respect of the affordability assessment guidelines is to arrange for access to data that allows credit providers to electronically verify income, discretionary income, and financial obligations of a prospective customer. For example, if credit bureaus could access SARS data, credit providers would be able to get an accurate and reliable picture of the customer's ability to afford the loan being applied for by using the complex financial models worked by the credit bureaus themselves. So this could be done through the existing credit bureaus. I think that would add a tremendous amount of validity to the data that is already out there. Just as an anecdote, I was told the story of a credit provider last year that had gone through substantial scams and frauds, even though they were manually verifying documentation, because these documents have become very easy to create fraudulent documents. So we also believe this is a potential negative effect on the arrears rate for credit providers, as it inhibits their ability to make accurate risk decisions. Okay, then, in terms of clause 6, the removal of adverse credit information, again, I'm not going to speak too much about that. There's been a lot of said about that. We do believe that would also have an impact on arrears rate. Being data junkies, I certainly, from a personal perspective, never liked the idea of expunging any data, okay? And I stand behind Treasury's proposal around adding to that data rather than removal of data in any environment. Amendments to the Code of Conduct to Combat Over-Indebtedness. We support the submission made by National Treasury, the Credit Bureau Association, MFSA, and Supervisors in respect of Clause 2, 3.11, 4.51, and would refer members of the committee to our written submission for further detail. Credit life insurance. At Wonga, we deliberately do not allow, offer, or enforce credit life insurance products on our loans. We are aware that this is a highly profitable practice for some credit providers, but we believe it is fundamentally unethical to be offered on short-term loans. At the very least, we suggest the NCR insists on absolute transparency regarding costs and conditions of credit life products offered on loans. Alternatively, we suggest restricting these products to be offered on long-term loans only, or certain value of loans. We believe that the risk taken, so the reason for this is we believe that the higher charges that are prescribed by the Act for short-term credit providers covers the inherent risk that is in that product offering. And to now go and add an additional charge to that, that's where we believe it incorrect. That the higher margin covers that risk. So we believe that tighter regulation of credit life insurance can only benefit consumers and lower interest rates for credit providers. Okay, I'm going to skip that. I think I'll refer to the submission just in the interest of time. So I would like to just summarize my presentation. Wong is a proudly South African digital finance company. We are 100% automated online credit provider, offering a unique flavor to South African consumers in terms of credit provision. We are fully compliant with NCA and are committed to responsible lending. This manual over here is an attempt over the last 6 months at quite a great resource and cost, where we document for anybody who is interested how we have complied with the National Credit Act in terms of our process electronically. Our sustainability as a business will never come at the cost of our customers' financial well-being. We're a profitable business employing in excess of 250 staff in South Africa, many of which serve other countries. We appreciate the opportunity, Madam Chairman, to engage with the committee to constructively find a solution which is a benefit of all parties. Our concerns with the amendment will arise mainly from those clauses or amendments that we can see are potentially damaging in the operations of an online business and prevent innovation financial services which we believe benefit the consumer.
Necessarily only ask questions, we also make comments, Mr. Herbert, as you by now you've realized. A digital finance is the future. Of course, a lot we heard already from the Reserve Bank this morning and Treasury the other day, as well as the NCA as well as DTI, but a lot of these loans are, if you like, digitized already in one sense or another. They may not be as sophisticated. But thank you very much for coming here with your team and giving us this presentation to Parliament. Right, over to members. And just so that you're aware, Mr. Hurwitz, I think I said earlier to someone, our members don't only sit on this committee, they sit on others, so they're called elsewhere. Honourable Swanepoel, Honourable Mabasa. I can't see a hand. Honourable Waihi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I must say this is a very good-looking presentation. Clearly shows that Wonga is making a lot of money and able to put such glossy presentations on the table. I would just like to ask a couple of questions. It's just a matter of interest. While I was sitting here, I was just being invited to make up some credit. I looked at your example on that 1,655 principal loan, and in that you had indicated a 21% interest rate for 20 days. When I did the calculation, it worked out that in fact the individual was repaying 392% on that loan, and of course it's because of the initiation fee, or 150 rand. But in fact, a person that loans from Wonga 1,655 in effect cost of that credit to 392% per annum, which is extremely high. And I think the issue here is whether you take a small loan or a big loan, it's a fixed rate of 150 rand. And therefore I think we should look at some sort of system of having a sliding scale. If you take a 150 rand loan, you're still going to pay 150 rand initiation fee. That's simply not right, in my view. The other thing I'd like to know is the loan has to be repaid before you can take up another loan, you said. I would like to know how many repeat customers you have, okay? So because I'm interested to know, because I can see the danger of a person taking a 150 rand loan, repaying you, then taking a 100 rand loan, repaying you, taking a 600 rand loan, repaying you, and it systematically is just going to get bigger and bigger into debt, and then it's be caught in the debt trap. That's very clear to me. The other thing I would like to get an understanding from you is how your affordability system works. And I would, it's a pity you didn't have in this document a application form. Because for a person to go online and simply answer a quick couple of questions, and that is, it's very easy, there's no manual assessment. It's very easy to manipulate data, not only from the borrower, the irresponsible borrower side as well. So I would very much like to see that sort of assessment that's done. The other thing is, you referred to SARS sharing data with SARS for verification. I could have it wrong, but my understanding is that SARS information is confidential and it cannot be shared. So I don't think that is workable and feasible. I could be wrong. And then lastly, just remind me or not, I could be totally wrong. I'll go and check it when I get home. But I recall when I was abroad that in the United Kingdom there's some issue. I think it's the payday lenders debate where Wonga also was questioned by the authorities of Parliament. If I'm wrong, please tell me, sir. If so, please just refresh our memories what the issue was in the United Kingdom with Wonga. Thank you very much.
You actually touched on one of the points that we were going to raise up here on that particular slide, the revolutionary approach, because it seems to be a revolutionary form of calculation in the end. Thank you. Honourable Mabasa?
Thank you. Thank you, Comrade Chair. Thanking Mr. Howitt for the input that has been made. But when I look at it, is the third page from the beginning where it says amendment, it leaves, and then it leaves with an arrow to arrears rate. So if you look at those, because I agree with all the 3 points that you have made. But when you look at the bill that we have before us, do you think that the bill subscribes to all the 3 points that you have made? I'm saying this given the background that we do have reckless lending. It's something that we must address. So how do you weigh that against the 3 points that you have made? Then another point is a point that has been made by Colleague Swanepoel here. How do you weigh the affordability of a prospective applicant before you grant a loan, seeing that you are not waiting with these people in a physical space? So how are you able to investigate? Isn't that also adding on to reckless lending? The last point is the youth and the students. They will be more lured into this approach, especially in the technology era. Are they going to end up having credit cards and having loans while prematurely, you know, in their vis-a-vis their waking life? So those are the questions and the comments that I am making. Thanks, Comrade Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Balsa. Honourable Y.E.
Thanks very much, Mr. President. I just want to raise a question around the proposal on the tighter regulation of credit insurance. can we be, you be explicit as to which are the most glaring areas and what kind of recommendation that you can have sponsor? I think the issue of the affordability has been raised by a number of speakers. How you screen, I will not label that particular part. But you also made mention of the bank assisted fraud. I don't know whether. Can you expand more in terms of the bank assisted fraud? What is the magnitude of that and what are the measures? Because I firmly believe that government has got regulatory bodies. What is it that we're not doing effective and efficiently enough in terms of dealing with that particular bad practice? The 90 days cap in terms of areas, you say you are profitable, but what is it that makes you to be profitable as compared, you have not compared yourself with your other counterparts and competitors, whilst you've got some of those flexible arrangements. I think the last one is the second page. In terms of the objectives of the submission, the first bullet point, which talks about the numerous perceptions about Wong and your project that you are offering. What is the basis of that particular statement? Because it implies a number of things. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, members. Yes, you see, we're just trying to get a clear analysis of these prescribed fees in relation to what we saw earlier on prescribed interest and fees, and prior to that, the revolutionary approach. How would we look at it? What is it that we're paying in admin fees, per se, which has already been addressed, I think, by your sub-honorables, there. And it's, one could still, in fact, have a serious challenge in this regard. On the one hand, while your staff may not be incentivized, as you put it, to offer credit, as to our nerves, on the other hand, there is, if you like, an incentive for those who hear about this, whether in various forms of the media, to get incentivized to increase their credits, because it would appear to be so easy, just 1,000 and 1,000, 800, 800, 8,000, very little. And I certainly agree that you need an element of credit to grow the economy. Of course we understand that. But you also need to generate savings. And we can't just increase. The moment South Africa is really experiencing a serious savings deficit. So, you know, it's not really our encouragement to kind of move up. And it's most unfortunate that people, when they think of their credit cards, etc., they don't say, think I owe the bank. They say, I've got so much money available. It isn't available. It blows. So we're not changing that culture. The moment we talk about how easy it is, how low the interest rate is, and when we say how low the interest rate is, I've only seen one longer advert on TV, etc., and I just remember a couple of comical figures running around. But the issue is this, that nowhere do I remember hearing about the admin fee, etc., you see. So I'm not suggesting that your admin fee is higher than others at all. But I'm saying it, you know, you talk about transparency here somewhere along the line. And indeed, transparency means let's get a clear account of when you're going to borrow 1,000, what is the interest? what is my fee for facilitating this as an institution? And if you default, where does this interest go? You know, that kind of thing. It's not clear. But it's very easy. I think you just ring up Mrs. Wanda or whatever. But, you know, that's how I remember it. I thought we had only one. Obviously made an impression on me. But over to you, Mr. Littlewood.
Okay, so, you know, I'm not sure exactly what calculation was done. But the one thing that I would say is to annualize a percentage rate on a short-term loan makes no sense. Okay? You know, again, our average loan is 23 days. Okay? So the prescribed rates are not pure interest. There's a service fee of 50 rand. There's an initiation fee, which is 10% of the value of the loan, okay, or in addition to 150 rand, if it's over 1,000 rand. So, I mean, this is not simple, right? And that's why we show the cost of credit, because even for people that do understand these things, it's not easy to calculate. And then, you know, in addition to that, you have 0.1% interest per day. And just in response to Madam Chair, it's very difficult to communicate that on a TV advert of 30 seconds, but we have all of that information on the front page of our website, which is the only page that people can apply. Okay. And I really support that in terms of transparency. So what we are flexing on our sliders are the rates that we charge that fall within the prescribed maximum of short-term credit transactions as per the Act. I would support a move to a pure interest rate. I do not know why there was this three categories that make it very difficult to display cost of credit. So I would absolutely support a pure interest rate. Okay, so I think your point two is very valid. We have something called a reputation forecast. From a sustainable business perspective, I absolutely agree. It is not in our business interest to grant somebody a loan of this nature 14 or 15 times a year. Through our reputation scorecard, we are comfortable and set that at roughly between 4 and 6, depending on the circumstances. So we actually limit that because we know the amount that has been taken. So, again, that is something that we do in practice through a reputation scorecard. So the affordability criteria is fairly complex in that we are gathering thousands of pieces of data that are all added into an algorithm. However, it starts off with asking the question of the applicants what their income expenses are, as would in any other application form. And we are able to, and obviously remember this is part of our secret sauce, there are people around the world that love to know how we're actually doing it because it hasn't been replicated. But we are able to, through confidence index and affordability, online affordability assessments, verify what they have told us for what we believe the reality is. Okay? Therefore, we also don't just assume that whatever the customer is telling us is correct. And we have a decline reason that is based on affordability check, which we see as a big part of our decline reasons when I talk about the 70% of first-time customers decline. Much of that is because of the affordability criteria. I don't have a valid answer for the question around confidential. I believe that would need to be investigated in terms of privacy policies where individuals would agree to access their data through the credit provider. So I'm not suggesting it's done as a link to SOL directly. Through the credit bureau where they are granted access in the interest of making better decisions. The UK is in a position where South Africa was 15 years ago when we were considering the National Credit Act. So they do not have the regulation that we do in terms of governing the myriad of providers that exist. And they're going through that process right now to essentially implement their version of the National Credit Act that covers the broad spectrum of credit providers. We are way ahead in terms of that provision, where those seven categories cover almost every provision. So that is what is going on in the UK. And if you will recall back 15 years in this country, that was a very hard process for the major players, particularly, and the banks were at the forefront of that. They took a hammer. Okay, so again, I try to clarify in my presentation, but that was the way that we look at the bill. Many of the clauses were amber for us, and obviously I didn't include that in my oral submission. But that's not to say that for the Debt Council Association, that wouldn't be a green or a red. And I hope I've made that clear. That is, you know, just the way that we looked at it. Okay, I think this idea, and I understand that it's very, it's very difficult to imagine, but this idea of having to work in a physical space to be able to make good decisions is erroneous, and I think is changing. And if I look forward 15 to 20 years, this will be the mainstream. Okay. Again, I think there's a lack of empirical evidence around how manual verification is better, okay, and also we see plenty of evidence, as I suggested, of scams around manual documents, and we would prefer to stay well away of that as a general principle. Again, youth and students generally don't have an income, okay, so it goes down to your affordability assessment and reflected in your arrears rate. Our arrears rates, to be transparent, are between 6 and 8%, which is comparable with some of the home loan lenders in this country, which is quite remarkable. Certainly when I was setting up this business, and by the way, the credit providers, the credit bureaus will provide the average arrears rate across different sectors of credit providers. It's freely available. So we are able to compare, we know what the averages are. And simplistically, my contention there is if there's a credit provider with 30% arrears rate, as opposed to one below single digits, you know, that's a good place to start. And that's really the only point that I'm making. So Credit Life Insurance is very slanted towards the credit provider. Okay? I mean, to be very crude about it, once a consumer has passed away, you know, the fact that they've got credit, depending on your stance, may or may not be relevant. So it's very geared towards the credit provider, in my opinion, okay? But my suggested proposal would be around either value or term. It would make no sense for me, even though I can, under current legislation, offer credit life insurance on a 30-day loan. But there's a point. So is it a 5-year loan? I can totally understand it for home loans, and I can totally understand it for larger values. But remember again, our first time offering is maximum of 2,500 rand. So in that context, I do not believe it makes sense. Thank you for the support. So I grant somebody a loan legitimately. I then go as per the process and I collect the money from them. Okay? In full, they've repaid again. The next day, they go into their bank and they go to their teller and they say, I've never heard of Wonga, I don't know who they are, I didn't take out this loan. Okay? The correct way to deal with that would be for the bank to then request the loan agreement and the debit for mandate from the credit provider. This process is too administratively intensive for banks, and they've stated that themselves. So what's practically happening is they are simply, without question, reversing that election. Okay? And, you know, again, that becomes an unfair debt, and I think that is very bad for, I see it in a very negative light, and it is a problem for some of the smaller credit providers particularly, and those guys that are offering kind of cell phones, because what will happen then, they'll ship out a cell phone, and the next day they'll just go and reverse the debit order. Now the credit providers incur the cost of the cell phone, and yeah, consumers know where to see. 90 days cap on arrears, how can you be profitable when you have such a flexible arrangement? So again, I think the people that put together the pricing in the original act took into account the risk of the risk profiles inherent in each sector. But from our perspective, you know, we transact totally online. So we have taken out the inefficiency and the cost of, for example, multiple branch networks. And we've done that in an efficient way by being able to make lending decisions online. And that has led to us being able to be profitable. I don't know what the basis of these misperceptions are, but obviously I have heard numerous rhetoric around, you know, I've even heard a thing called motion leases. And I hope that you can see that there's a distinct difference between what we're doing and that sector. So I can't comment on the basis of it. Perhaps it's because of I, but I have an idea.
Okay, I'll leave that to address the question. Thank you very much, Mr. Hurwitz. Look, one of the areas which one certainly would want to look at as a very creative proposal, the point of that is established in all institutions of freezing interest at 90 days in arrears. I think that's quite innovative and worthwhile for us to look at that particular area itself. But as you just said at the end, possibly your method of going the digital route, as it were, has enabled you to effect certain cost efficiencies, as it were, along the way. But we certainly want to study at length and just to ensure that we're not making that slope. You know, if you're skiing and the slope gets too steep and you're not experienced here, you know what happens, don't you? So we don't want people getting head injuries here, as it were, along this very steep, easy slope. But I do want to thank you. It is a different presentation we've had here in this week. And so it adds to the information we have to enable us to deliberate more effectively on what is the best course to go and how effectively we will, you know, study and certainly make certain changes if necessary to what is on the table. So we do want to thank you and your team for being here, but also we'd like to just remind you along with everyone else that the committee secretary we'll be coming back to you with some outstanding areas as we move on into the piece of legislation that we have. But again, one must make it very clear that this accumulation of interest which we see happening, this is why I mentioned this 90-day freezing, makes it very difficult for countries to realize the potential of their people and of their own economies. And that also then cuts, reduces the purchasing power of people. It more has to go out on paying loans and interest and administration fees. You have less effective purchasing power. So
So this sort of thing is very important. That's the kind of thing we try to take into account. And how does it affect people right on the ground? Is it the answer to do what you're doing? I'm not sure how many of those. I know Honourable Barker will often bring up rural areas alongside the co-op issue. I don't know how many of them in these rural areas where we are experiencing this element of instability in relationship to the disposable income, if you like, you know, whether they are looking at the internet to make access, but then perhaps they aren't an LCM, you know, the ranges that you say you're dealing with, 6 to 10. And I know they've got those cell phones, etc., but I'm just saying, you know, gee, if I was an underground mine, I don't know when I'm going to have a chance to be doing that. Just run around the corner to my Shawnee Seaworld. No. So I think we need also, while you said there were two South Africans developed this concept, they did develop it overseas, and I wonder how much rural travel they done here in our own country. So I think we must congratulate them for developing an innovative thing, but I'm concerned as to how applicable or how constructive it would be to certain groups, as it were, in this regard. But thank you, we will study this, and that applies to all the inputs we have received and stakeholders. I really appreciate your patience, in particular to committee members, who I cannot tell you how busy they are. They're not going home to have a free weekend, no one. They're actually going home to do, not home, but to their constituencies, to do a lot more hard work, including tonight. So I do appreciate you being here for so long. But members, just to remind you, we want to just look at Mondays, not Mondays, don't let me frighten you, Tuesday schedule. Mr. Herman?
Michel Jean-Christophe, QZ 930 in VU119, we will receive the response from DTI on the submission of that May.
And I'm sure you can appreciate how important that is, 9:30 on Tuesday. It's a full day. Please, it's an important day. Any stakeholder that wants to listen to it is welcome. Thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.